WCFW HD2 Chippewa Falls, W228EP Eau Claire,
and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
US Kids presents What to Expect When You're Expecting a Teenager. Learning the lingo.
Jelly. Jelly adjective. Jelly is a shorter, better way to say jealous. As in, Chloe, I am like so jelly of your unicorn phone case.
You don't have to speak teen to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will love you just the same. Visit AdoptUSKids.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, AdoptUSKids, and the Ad Council.
When you're high, you feel different. You think different, you talk different, you draw different, you listen to music different, but you probably knew that. Problem is, you also drive different, and not in a good way. That's why driving high is illegal everywhere. So if you're high, just don't drive. Make a plan to get a sober ride. Because if you feel different, you drive different. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Don't let biased algorithms, or degree screens, or exclusive professional networks, or stereotypes, don't let anything keep you from discovering the half of the workforce who are stars. Workers skilled through alternative routes rather than a bachelor's degree. It's time to tear the paper ceiling and see the stars beyond it. Find out how you can make stars part of your talent strategy at tearthepaperceiling.org. Brought to you by Opportunity at Work and the Ad Council.
RPG came through the belly of the aircraft. We don't talk about the female combat wounded. These are our daughters and our sisters and our mothers. Wounded Warrior Project came into my life and taught me how to stand back up and get back in the fight.
The truth is, I think we all have this strength inside of us, but until you're tested, you just don't know it's there.
See how Wounded Warrior Project empowers women veterans like Beth by visiting woundedwarriorproject.org/empowerwomenvets.
Mino and the Mayor.
The Magic Man, Don Mikowski.
I met you one time. You won't remember this because you met a million people, but I met you at an airport.
Oh, yeah. Here, you remember that match?
I remember. Yeah.
You were the guy in the airport. Oh, that's right.
Yeah. Now, I'm sure you've never
How
met
you
anyone.
Been?
I just was telling Johnny yesterday when I heard you were coming on, you were so nice to me. And I just introduced myself. Hey, Smith from Green Bay. And you're one of the good guys.
Weekday mornings from 6 until 8 on the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, and Oshkosh Air Support, WIS. The Todd Alba Show.
What makes our society great is that we can believe in something bigger than ourselves. It doesn't matter whether it's a soccer team or whether it's a political movement or whether it's a public school, whether it's a neighborhood PTA, a bake sale. It's about interacting with our friends and neighbors and making our communities better for having come together around a common cause.
The Todd Alba Show. Weekday afternoons from 1 till 3 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. A report from the U.S. Defense Department finds 245 of its 275 installations are close to groundwater sources. That includes the West Bend Armory in Wisconsin. With more now, here's Edwin J. Vieira.
A new report finds plumes of so-called forever chemicals from Department of Defense installations are located dangerously close to groundwater sources. Cleanup is underway on the majority of them, with remediation plans for the others being developed. Jared Hayes with the Environmental Working Group describes where the chemicals came from.
The primary source of PFAS into the groundwater coming from these bases has been the historic use of firefighting foam containing PFAS, known as AFFF. These foams were used for decades, primarily to put out oil and gas fires or aviation fires.
He explains these foams were washed off the tarmac and into the soil, where they could leach into groundwater supplies. Several methods, such as granular activated carbon and reverse osmosis, have shown success in removing PFAS from drinking water, but they don't break down these chemicals. New regulations have been proposed by the Environmental Protection Agency to keep people safe from PFAS. The National Primary Drinking Water Regulation would establish maximum containment levels for numerous forever chemicals. Hayes says this is important since there are numerous health impacts to ingesting PFAS.
Long-term, these exposure through drinking water. PFAS has been linked to development of different types of cancer. It has also been linked to immune system harms, raised cholesterol, as well as birth defects.
This is Edwin J. Vieira. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
And this is Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
Hi, we're the Goo Goo Dolls. We're fortunate that our daughters have what they need to grow and learn. But that isn't the case for nearly 13 million kids in the U.S. that struggle with hunger.
Childhood hunger is a heartbreaking reality that Feeding America is working to change. Each year, the Feeding America network of food banks rescues billions of pounds of good food that would have gone to waste and provides it to families and children in need.
You can help kids in need in your community by visiting feedingamerica.org.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
My name is Teresa Barber. I was in the United States Navy, and I served overseas in the Middle East and Africa. Early on in my career, I had a commander that taught our suicide prevention training, and the very next day, he took his own life. 90% of suicide attempts involving a gun are fatal. My way of continuing my service is to help protect my community by being a responsible gun.
Welcome. Grab your favorite morning beverage and join us for Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel. You don't know me, but I'm your brother. Sampling the news desserts of the week, here is your host, Jim Santel.
Good morning. This is Morning Cannolis, and my name is Jim Santel. Thank you so much for joining me in this, our second hour here on Saturday, October 21st. Delighted to have you with us on this, our 68th broadcast. 68th broadcast is going on the air in June of last year, talking as always about the administration of justice and trappings of government and the hope for the administration of justice, the extension of law in all areas of our lives. Why? To promote our lives and to make our lives better. That's the reason why we have order. That's the reason why we have systems of justice in our nation and other republics, other nations around the planet. This morning, talking in this hour, not only about many of those pieces of litigation pending in our federal and state courts, finishing up some of our discussion from the first hour, and then moving into other areas where likewise attention has been paid this past week to things going on, especially important, this major piece of litigation, a criminal case in the state of Georgia in Fulton County, which is basically Atlanta. Some major developments that I would offer are as significant as the indictments themselves when it comes to decisions being made by two of the identified indicted defendants in that state criminal case to plead guilty and to cooperate with the government. We'll talk about that in just a few moments. We're also going to talk a little bit about something that happened with respect to one of the fake electors, the charged fake electors in the state of Michigan. And all of that leads to questions and comments, observations by our listeners. We appreciate that tremendously. Luke Mathers and I are taking your phone calls, your comments, your questions, oral and written, 844-967-2789. And as indicated in our first hour, Linda, appreciate very much your comment, your question about whether or not other people, including our present senior senator, might at some point be indicted in one of these matters. And let's take up that question right now, hinted at it already somewhat in our first hour. All of these cases, again, focusing upon Donald Trump, but plainly other people as well. Even the documents case, as I said right before the break, the top of the hour break, involving other individuals who were involved with Donald Trump, purportedly, allegedly. That case now focusing on whether or not a particular lawyer should continue to represent one of the defendants in the wake of his previous representation of one of the witnesses, a fairly thorny issue having to do with conflict of interest. The defendant in that case waiving that, saying, I'd like to continue with the attorney. We'll see what the Department of Justice says about all that. All of those kinds of things, focusing upon the notion that this is not just about Donald Trump. He is certainly the major character, the major feature, the major actor in these civil and criminal cases as well. But he's not the only one. And as I indicated previously, just because these cases have been charged, the case in the District of Columbia, the case in Florida, the case in Georgia, the state case, and other matters, other civil cases, including the New York case, the criminal case that we're not talking a lot about this morning, involving the allegations of hush money being paid to a porn star in connection with the 2016 election, that being prosecuted by Alvin Bragg, who's the district attorney in Manhattan. All these cases involving Donald Trump at their core, but nonetheless, other individuals as well. The reality is that in any of them, if there are additional defendants who likewise are involved in the predicate, the core allegations in those complaints, the prosecutors can seek what's called a superseding indictment. Indeed, in the Mar-a-Lago case, that's exactly what Jack Smith did, to add these additional defendants who engaged in obstruction of justice when it came to allegedly destroying some of the evidence, some of the videotape of these documents being moved around at Mar-a-Lago. Jack Smith did just that. He added more defendants. And indeed, the strong suggestion is that when it comes to this pending case in front of Judge Chutkan, which you talked about at great length in our first hour, when we talk about that particular case, we know once again that Donald Trump, the singular defendant, four counts against him, but there are more layers of individuals who are involved plainly with the defendant, with Donald Trump, and Jack Smith knows that the indicting grand juries have known it as well. As I indicated in the first hour, many of those people identify not by name, but we know them because of the descriptions of them, and they're being named in other indictments. Many of those defendants likely going to be charged federally by Jack Smith at some point down the road. And they, once again, people like Rudy Giuliani and John Eastman, Jeffrey Clark, Boris Epstein, others also involved in the January 6th event, could also involve federal charges against the fake electors, including the fake electors in Michigan and Georgia, already the subject of state charges. Nothing, as we have said before, prevents the federal government for charging federally those people who have also been charged in the state system. Why? Because they vindicate different interests, and they're charged plainly under different sets, different codes of laws, state codes versus the federal codes, but different interests, different vindicated purposes being advanced by federal and state prosecutions. They can happen in a parallel universe, if you will. They can happen in a parallel proceeding. Often the federal government permits the state to go ahead before prosecuting, but nothing wrong legally, nothing wrong ethically by going down that parallel route. So we may well see that. And to answer finally, Linda, your good question about other defendants, including arguably members of the Congress, members of the Senate, maybe the House of Representatives who may have been involved likewise in this broad, very sweeping effort on January 6th, before January 6th, after January 6th, to undermine, to interfere with the results of the 2020 election. Is it possible to indict other individuals? Absolutely. And it is highly likely that people like Jack Smith, and maybe Fannie Willis as well. We actually know with respect to Fannie Willis that there were other people recommended to her by the investigating grand jury, recommended to her for indictment, and she chose not to indict them. Doesn't mean that she can't indict them down the road, but just that in her sweeping indictment returned by the indicting grand jury several months ago, the 19 people there are the first ones that she indicted. And we're going to talk in just a few moments or so about the significant event having to do with two of those defendants. They are Sidney Powell and Kenneth Chesbrough. Fannie Willis could indict more people. It is the simple procedural truth that Jack Smith could also, and likely will at some point down the road, indict other people beyond just Donald Trump federally for their involvement. It could be these six unindicted people, could be the fake electors, could be other people known and unknown to us publicly. So all of those things are possibilities, Linda, and I appreciate very much the call. Appreciate very much the comment and the support of our efforts this morning to engage in some civics, as we always do here on this morning program. Also appreciating, of course, your calls. And Mark is on the line from Prairie du Sac. Mark, glad to have you with us this morning. Your comment or question about the subject matters we've been talking about.
Well, it occurred to me, listening this morning and listening previously, that I don't think that just because Donald Trump is no longer president of the United States, he is still not bound by his oath that he took to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. And one of the provisions in the Constitution, of course, is the preamble to the Constitution. And establish justice and promote domestic tranquility or ensure domestic tranquility is something he's violating now with all his rhetoric on you know, going after the people that are, you know, going out, you know, that he thinks are going after him for his violations of the law. And it feeds into the whole thing of now the whole kerfuffle over the Speaker of the House. I mean, death threats are coming in for people not voting for Jim Jordan. I mean, that, I guess my view is that any of these threats coming in, and I'll need to be looked at with the ultimate seriousness, and, you know, people need to be, you know, need to be prosecuted for those, for making those threats, that because they're making threats over, you know, people, you know, criticizing Donald Trump or prosecuting Donald Trump for his crimes, and that, and for people going after the whole conspiracy to keep him in office after, you know, after he lost the election in 2020. And let's remember, more and more evidence is coming out that this plot started taking place before the election even happened. They're putting in place plans to, you know, to not ensure the peaceful transition of power, which Donald Trump never tried to do, is because there's no transition team between Donald Trump and Joe Biden's team. That I heard that they never would, you know, because so that they just kind of went running out of the office, you know, and hanging a lot of problems to Joe, handing a lot of problems off to Joe Biden that should have been
right. And a couple of several very good points there, Mark. Always appreciate your call, your perspective. And let's unpack a couple of those. First, about this notion, again, in the preamble of the Constitution, always good to go back and look at what our founding fathers said in establishing our nation. And again, that obligation, as you said at the outset, Mark, to for any president, anyone who takes an oath, becomes a part of the government, required to take an oath. I took an oath of office when I was an assistant U.S. attorney, when I was the U.S. attorney, all those kinds of important positions that many, many civil servants, tens of thousands of civil servants across the government, the federal government, hundreds of thousands of state employees also take an oath. And they take an oath not only at the Constitution of the United States, but the particular states in which they're working. Basically, that oath says, I am a servant, right? I'm a servant of the public, and I'm obliged to do exactly, Mark, what you said, which is preserve the institutions of our government. And why do we do that? We do that for the social order, for the goodness of our nation, our state, our community. And while it is true that Donald Trump may not presently be under that continuing oath, the reality is he's running for president, right? And when he takes that oath, if indeed America should re-elect him to the presidency in just a little bit over a year from now, he's going to be obliged to do that. And so I'd offer, Mark, that your very good and thoughtful observation about this oath of office is something that should be a part of the measurement of his qualification to serve as the president. And when, again, whether you look at these particular orders that he's violating in New York State, arguably violating already in the federal court in the District of Columbia, that is an order that is clear and unequivocal. And as you indicated so well, Mark, he is engaging in conduct that undermines the process of justice. He is affecting witnesses. He's affecting the jury pool. He's affecting the very administration that people like Judge Chutkan and Judge Engoron are trying to administer well. That, I would offer, is the kind of thing that should disqualify you from running for any office, being appointed to any office, because not only you violated that oath which you previously took, but you are acting in a way that's contrary to the basic understandings of how the rule of law works in our nation. When we come back, I'm going to take another caller or two and then move on to other areas, including this important prosecution, criminal prosecution, continuing in the state of Georgia. Stay with us for that important discussion.
Hi, we're the Goo Goo Dolls. We're fortunate that our daughters have what they need to grow and learn. But that isn't the case for nearly 13 million kids in the U.S. that struggle with hunger.
Childhood hunger is a heartbreaking reality that Feeding America is working to change. Each year, the Feeding America network of food banks rescues billions of pounds of good food that would have gone to waste and provides it to families and children in need.
You can help kids in need in your community by visiting feedingamerica.org.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
My name is Teresa Barber. I was in the United States Navy, and I served overseas in the Middle East and Africa. Early on in my career, I had a commander that taught our suicide prevention training, and the very next day, he took his own life. 90% of suicide attempts involving a gun are fatal. My way of continuing my service is to help protect my community by being a responsible gun owner and by storing firearms safely. Store all your guns securely. Help stop suicide.
Brought to you by End Family Fire and the Ad Council.
Time out!
All right! Remember, we're a team that plays together. Listen, the winning will take care of itself. We just have to get everyone involved.
In interscholastic sports, we celebrate what makes every one of us unique. And in the pursuit of a common goal, everyone in the huddle, in the bleachers, and in the community comes together. This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, chance of rain, partly sunny, highs near 56. Tonight, some fog possible, otherwise mostly cloudy, and lows in the mid-30s. For Sunday, mostly sunny, mid-50s. Sunday night, mostly cloudy with a low around 43. Monday, around 57 with a chance of rain.
Right now, it's 49.
And we are back here in Morning Cannolis. Thank you, as always, for your comments and questions. Appreciate those from our listeners this morning, as always. And in that connection, as we talk about justice in America, justice in the state of Wisconsin, and government in particular, we have another caller on the line, Ken, calling in from Milwaukee. Ken, appreciate your being a part of our broadcast this morning. Your comment or question about matters on your mind.
Good morning, Jim. I don't mean to change the topic, but I'm curious if you could share with me your knowledge of felony crimes, and specifically I'm going to refer to the murder of that letter carrier last December in Milwaukee.
Yes.
And then also another postal crime, if I may describe it this way, is 8 defendants who were stealing postal carrier equipment from the carriers and using it to access the blue collection boxes.
Sure.
and their felony crimes. It does 10 months after the criminal act occur sound like a short time before defendants and their case get adjudicated for a murder or a lesser crime such as these felonies of crimes against the post office and their employees?
Sure. Great, Ken. I appreciate the question. Not at all a diversion from our agenda, because it falls right in the middle of issues we discuss all the time. So I appreciate the observation, the question about, let's talk just about what we know in the public domain. You've accurately identified that way back in January, in the wake of the violence you described, the U.S. Attorney's Office, which, again, I used to be working in for about 30 years and was honored on behalf of the people of the Eastern District of Wisconsin, the entire state, to serve as the principal federal law enforcement officer there for that period of time, principally during the Obama administration. More recently, my first assistant, the fellow who was the second to my left or right hand during the time, is now the U.S. attorney there. And back in January of this year, he announced that a federal grand jury, just like the grand juries in these other cases we've talked about, have in fact indicted 4 people in relation to this murder of the postal employee that you're talking about. And yes, indeed, a serious crime, absolutely. It's not often that murder is the subject of federal prosecutions, but does in fact happen, especially when it has to do with the Postal Service. And even though the Postal Service these days has and has been for a long period of time a quasi-independent agency, both criminally and civilly, we represent, the government represents, the Department of Justice, the U.S. Attorney's Offices represent the Postal Service because of the government function that they perform. And indeed, way back in January, again, prior to this time, but at that time, the federal grand jury sitting in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, the Eastern District, did in fact return this indictment against 2 Milwaukee men for their involvement and at least 2 other people for providing some false statements to law enforcement investigating that murder. Again, that, and you've also described, again, related or unrelated matters involving other postal crimes. All of them, all of those kinds of things you're describing, Ken, prohibited by the federal criminal code. Now, they could also be state offenses, depending upon how it is they're charged, what the facts of those cases are, but certainly federal cases in particular, because of the government service, the postal service that these employees provide, the threats to their safety and security, the threats that, that these things pose to all of us by virtue of the attacks on our good and decent and public servants doing this important work for us, delivering our mail, ensuring that communication is preserved and promoted. All of that, again, appropriately prosecuted by the federal government, and in particular the U.S. Attorney's Office, in the district in which the conduct happens. And that's why the federal crimes, and again, involving the access information that you described, Ken, and certainly the murder itself, all of those things happening in eastern Wisconsin, Milwaukee in particular, appropriately the subject of an indictment. Appropriate, why would we do that? Once again, we do it for two reasons. One, of course, deterrence of the individuals involved, stopping them, one of the principal reasons for criminal prosecution, stopping them from doing what they're doing, sending the message to them that this conduct is unacceptable, contrary to law, contrary to who we are as a nation and a community. And second, sending the other deterrent message, general deterrence to the entire community, that if you do this kind of thing, if you attack our good and decent and hardworking postal workers, if you steal equipment, if you kill a member of our postal service, you will face severe consequences, and indeed these folks will. Now, the question that you ask, Ken, is, gosh, it's been now 9-10 months or so since these indictments returned. And the answer, of course, is that there's a Speedy Trial Act in the federal system, as there is in the state system. But on a regular basis, there are appropriate exclusions, appropriate time periods that are excluded from the computation of that based upon the conduct of discovery, that is a production of information, motion practice, the kinds of things that are going on in those Donald Trump cases that we talked about previously. If a case is sufficiently complex, and certainly in a murder case, these kinds of things that you're describing, you've identified, can all of that appropriately excluded. And so at some point fairly soon, those cases should in fact go to trial, but not completely unusual that in a serious offense, conduct like this charged in these indictments, that it should not be disposed of quickly. As always, and I think the implicit, if not explicit, point of your question, Ken, is justice delayed, justice denied. That's the reason why there's a Speedy Trial Act. That's the reason why we promote expedited justice. We'll look forward to that happening in those postal cases, as we do in all of these other cases that are on the national scope here, of course, in the local scope. And I would offer to you, Ken, appreciating so much the comment that you made, this kind of thing, attack upon federal workers, people involved in supporting us in the community, that's the kind of thing that should get national attention for the deterrent effect it has, and sending the message that that kind of behavior will, in fact, result in indictments and will, in fact, result in the strongest of judgments against you. When we come back, we're going to go back to some of those cases involving the former president in the state system and in other circumstances around the nation. Stay with us for that discussion.
CBS News special report in southern Gaza this morning. Humanitarian aid.
meat, including medicine and some food, started coming into the Strip through the border crossing in Egypt. The BBC's Tom Bateman is there.
The UN certainly is present there, so they may want to carry out those inspections. And then, this is all going to take time because they've got to get the stuff into Palestinian lorries so that it can then be distributed.
The UN's Relief and Works Agency says Gaza's 2.3 million people are at risk, and some have been drinking dirty water and are starving.
The needs are huge. At least 1 million people have been displaced, forced to leave their homes. Many, many of them, half a million, in fact, are in UNRWA shelters. We are stretched ourselves, cannot deliver, cannot really respond to all the needs on the ground.
CBS News Special Report. I'm Allison Keys.
Hi, we're the Goo Goo Dolls. We're fortunate that our daughters have what they need to grow and learn. But that isn't the case for nearly 13 million kids in the U.S. that struggle with hunger.
Childhood hunger is a heartbreaking reality that Feeding America is working.
Hi, we're the Goo Goo Dolls. We're fortunate that our daughters have what they need to grow and learn. But that isn't the case for nearly 13 million kids in the U.S. that struggle with hunger.
Childhood hunger is a heartbreaking reality that Feeding America is working to change. Each year, the Feeding America network of food banks rescues billions of pounds of good food that would have gone to waste and provides it to families and children in need.
You can help kids in need in your community by visiting feedingamerica.org.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
My name is Teresa Barber. I was in the United States Navy, and I served overseas in the Middle East and Africa. Early on in my career, I had a commander that taught our suicide prevention training, and the very next day, he took his own life. 90% of suicide attempts involving a gun are fatal. My way of continuing my service is to help protect my community by being a responsible gun owner and by storing firearms safely. Store all your guns securely. Help stop suicide.
Brought to you by End Family Fire and the Ad Council.
Time out!
Remember, we're a team that plays together. Listen, the winning will take care of itself. We just have to get everyone involved.
In interscholastic sports, we celebrate what makes every one of us unique. And in the pursuit of a common goal, everyone in the huddle, in the bleachers, and in the community comes together. This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
93.5, The Tap.
Why are interscholastic sports called the last classroom of the day? Because they teach students important life lessons like teamwork, accountability, and perseverance. School sports are so much more than a game. They're about developing the whole person. That's why they're an essential part of every student's education.
Encourage your student to participate in the last classroom of the day. Interscholastic sports in Wisconsin. This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
If you love them enough to listen to them practice the same song on tuba.
And we are back here in our weekly discussion of government and law and justice in America. Appreciating very much your calls, your comments, written, oral. Thank you very much for those. Thank all of you for joining me this morning on Morning Cannolis. My good friend and colleague, outstanding producer, Luke Mathers, and I in the studios here in Madison enjoying this wonderful Saturday morning in the state of Wisconsin, even as we talk about these various serious matters related to the rule of law and the administration of justice in America. Let's go now south. Let's go to Georgia, as promised in our first hour and in this second hour of our broadcast. We know that Fannie Willis, a number of months ago, returned through the grand jury process to the state system there, not the federal system, the state system, in the wake of an investigative grand jury recommending to her, many people, to be indicted. She identified 19 of them, including, once again, the former President Donald Trump, including 18 other people, some of them false electors, some of them engaged in other attempts, allegedly, according to the indictment, to undermine the results of the election there in Georgia through various mechanisms described in great particularity in this RICO charge, this omnibus RICO charge. Every single person there charged with a violation of the Racketeer Influence and Corrupt Organizations Act in Georgia under state law, a criminal case. And we know already that among those 19, there's already been at least one defendant who pled guilty. He was the bail bondsman. We'll talk about him more in just a moment or so. But as this case is proceeding to trial, we know that the judge who's presiding over the case, his name is Scott McAfee. He is the state court judge assigned responsibility for this criminal prosecution, the oversight of it, having lots and lots of hearings, as is appropriate during this period, this pretrial period. And during the course of the discussions with the attorneys, two of those defendants, their names, of course, Sidney Powell and Kenneth Chesbro, both indicated they want to go to trial promptly. And they invoked something called the Georgia Speedy Trial Act. We talked about this already in just a previous segment here. This statute, there's a federal statute, says the same thing. State statute also, in the trappings of Georgia law, says that, again, in the interest of moving cases toward expeditious resolution, defendants, and I would offer the public as well, represented by the government, by the prosecutor's office, have a right to express their interest in getting the case resolved expeditiously and having the judge make those findings, schedule those cases on. And that's exactly what two of these defendants did, Sidney Powell and Kenneth Chesbro. And as late as the middle of this week, the two of them, through their attorneys, were indicating we're going to trial. Believe it or not, the judge, again, Scott McAfee, anticipating the empanelment of a jury. Two of these defendants, among the 19, going to trial on the charges against them there in the state. He brought in 450 people. 450 people were coming into the Fulton County Justice Facility on Friday to begin for this selection process. And on Monday, the plan was that this case against two of the 19 would proceed. Two of the 19, again, this other one having previously pled guilty. 16 of them, in other words, still out there for prosecution down the road, another trial. And we know about two very significant things, I would argue, as I said before, a couple of most important significant things that have happened in all of these cases since the time of the indictments. All the cases we're talking about, these things happened just this past week. We know that on the cusp of the start of the trial, as late as Wednesday or so, both of these defendants, again, anticipating going to trial, but we know that on the 19th, just this past week, Sidney Powell, who charitably spun some of the wildest theories about ballot fraud and election fraud as a member of the Trump team after he decisively lost the 2020 election. She pleaded guilty. She pleaded guilty on Thursday morning to six misdemeanor counts put forth by the prosecution and basically brought to a close the charges against her in this omnibus sweeping indictment brought by the grand jury and Fannie Willis there in Georgia. She, again, one of the 19, along with Ken Chesbro. We'll talk about him in just a moment. And significantly, as a result of her agreement to plead guilty to these six misdemeanor counts, she also agreed, very importantly, to testify against any of the remaining defendants, to cooperate with the government in their further investigation and their presentation of the case against everybody else in this case. Six counts, misdemeanor counts of conspiracy to commit intentional interference with performance of election duties. And this significantly less severe outcome is prompted undeniably, the decision by Fannie Willis to dismiss, if you will, the felony counts against her and let her plead guilty to these lesser counts, undeniably because they identified in Sidney Powell something about her additional testimony that they wanted and that would be hugely important to the administration of justice in the presentation of the trial, maybe other investigative efforts if more people are indicted. Sidney Powell plainly, in the course of what has almost certainly been a proffer, P-R-O-F-F-E-R, said to them, here are the things that I can tell you about in connection with what? Certainly the allegations against her in the complaint, but also importantly, what discussions I had with people like Rudy Giuliani and John Eastman and Jeffrey Clark and Boris Epstein and many, many other people charged in that Georgia case, including Donald Trump. She was there, we know, during many of those White House, those Oval Office meetings in which there were discussions about what do we do to try to stop Joe Biden from becoming the next president of the United States of America. She was among those discussions that proposed seizing voting machines. Significantly, there was a proposal floated up, not pursued by the president at that time, to name her as special counsel for the pursuit of these investigations involving what happened in the 2020 election. She appeared publicly. You have seen them. You recall them well. All of these allegations about breaches of voting equipment in various locations around the country, allegations of that, frankly, even the president of the United States of America, when he saw some of them, said, gosh, that's crazy. His word, not mine. Sidney Powell now pleading guilty in Georgia to these six misdemeanor counts and bringing to an end her involvement, at least the trial involvement, against her as it was going to go ahead as a part of this omnibus proceeding. Specifically, her role there largely related to helping to carry out this breach of voting equipment in this place called in the rural county called Coffee County, several hundred miles just south of Atlanta. For doing all that and for now agreeing to plead guilty to these six misdemeanor counts, she is fined $6,000, not a lot of money, not a lot of money, and pays $2,700 in restitution. And again, she is required to turn over her documents to the state. She is going to write an apology letter to the state citizens for doing what she did and trying not only to undermine the results of the election, to interfere, but also apologizing for the representations she made there in Georgia, other places around the country. The big takeaway on this, as it is with a co-defendant about whom we'll talk next, the big takeaway, of course, is that this is huge. This is huge, not only because of the cooperation. She plainly among the unindicted co-conspirators in the Jack Smith indictment, the January 6th interference indictment, now cooperating with government officials and describing as a part of her obligation to live up to the terms and conditions of her plea, everything she knows. And indeed, she apparently put together a videotape as late as Wednesday and provided that to Fannie Willis and said, here's the kind of thing that I can talk about. We haven't seen that yet. We may at some point. We may never see that. But again, this commitment to go ahead and now testify on behalf of the government, huge, providing information, presumably the state authorities, arguably useful to the federal authorities as well, in identifying those things that may not even be known yet by Fannie Willis and by other prosecutors out there, a significant concern for Donald Trump and all these other defendants, because Sidney Powell was there. She was there in the room when it happened, so to speak, and she is the kind of person who can come forward and describe the conversations that would further establish not only what was said, what was done, but the intent to undermine the election in 2020. Huge news. And then as if we've got enough there on Thursday, on Friday morning, after Sidney Powell agrees to plead guilty, yes, Ken Chesbrough also surprisingly comes in, probably prompted in part by the fact that his co-defendant has now pled guilty. He comes in and he also appears in front of Judge Scott McAfee, and he pleads guilty to a single felony charge. The first time a felony charge has been entered in this prosecution. He is pleading guilty to filing of false documents, and he receives 5 years probation, a $5,000 fine, and once again, agrees to provide testimony, documents, and evidence. The same kind of thing, different plea agreement, different understanding. He's pleading guilty to one felony, the Sidney Powell prosecution, based upon six misdemeanor counts, but nonetheless, same kind of dramatic import. We now have Ken Chesbrough coming forward and also providing information. Why is he so important in all of this? We know from our discussion of the indictments involving the other five or six unindicted co-conspirators. We know from the indictment that Fannie Willis returned in the state of Georgia that this man was also right there. Ken Chesbrough was the author, allegedly, purportedly, of the so-called Wisconsin Memorandum that got this whole scheme underway. He was the one who articulated this view about getting the fake electors to come forward and eventually evolving into what may have been legitimately initially a view about the possible way legitimately, lawfully to challenge the election evolved into something illegal from his pen. And along with John Eastman and other people having discussions not only among these other co-conspirators, but even with the President of the United States of America. And again, like Sidney Powell, can then come forward and describe to the prosecutors, state prosecutors there in Georgia, what he knows about other defendants, including Donald Trump, but all the other people also named in that indictment. A very significant result. Not good news for Donald Trump this past week. Not the kind of thing that he was hoping would happen. Plainly, as late as later in the week, they were still anticipating going to trial. The judge now has not free time on his calendar, but the jury will not be impaneled. Is not being impaneled. All those folks, 450 of them, told to go home. No trial starting on Monday as it was scheduled to start. That not happening as we go forward here on this particular trial. And so big news coming out of Georgia just this past week. The indictments against Ken Chesbrough and against Sidney Powell dismissed in exchange for their plea agreements to misdemeanors and felonies, and significantly, the agreement to testify, to provide information, that is already underway. And certainly there are an awful lot of people who are asking, what about the uses of this testimony, this information that they're probably providing as we speak, have already provided this past week? What about the uses of that in other forums? And probably, I don't know anything more than you know, but probably, highly likely, that as this case goes forward, the attorneys for them are also reaching out to those other places where they've got exposure, like, for example, the District of Columbia District Court. The case pending right now in front of Tanya Chutkan, the case that Jack Smith might in fact bring against other people, including the unindicted co-conspirators. Once again, their names, Rudy Giuliani and John Eastman, Jeffrey Clark, this former Department of Justice person, Boris Epstein, sort of this advisor along the way, and yes, indeed, Sidney Powell, well, she was identified as unindicted co-conspirator number 3. Ken Chesbrough was number 5 in that indictment. And could that information be provided, helped the criminal prosecution? Absolutely. And again, the attorneys for Chesbrough and Powell, if they're wise, and they are almost certainly reaching out to the federal government and saying, let's begin to talk about an omnibus resolution. Is it possible that the Jack Smith indictments could be expanded, could be superseded to include Powell and Chesbrough? Yes, absolutely. Their attorneys, again, now that they're agreeing to testify with the government, are almost certainly reaching out as well to the Department of Justice in Washington, D.C., saying, let's also talk with you about some disposition of the cases, the potential cases, so that they don't have to go to trial down the road. Again, presumably including as a part of that package, an agreement to testify against all of the other defendants, including the one who's now been indicted. His name, as we all know well, is Donald John Trump. Very important news, as important, as I said, as the return of the indictments themselves. When we come back, a few more comments about fake electors, and then some comments about the Supreme Court as well in our final segment here on Saturday, October 21 on Morning Cannoli. Stay with us for that final discussion. Under my thumb, her eyes are just kept to herself.
Hi, we're the Goo Goo Dolls. We're fortunate that our daughters have what they need to grow and learn. But that isn't the case for nearly 13 million kids in the U.S. that struggle with hunger.
Childhood hunger is a heartbreaking reality that Feeding America is working to change. Each year, the Feeding America network of food banks rescues billions of pounds of good food that would have gone to waste and provides it to families and children in need.
You can help kids in need in your community by visiting feedingamerica.org.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
My name is Teresa Barber. I was in the United States Navy, and I served overseas in the Middle East and Africa. Early on in my career, I had a commander that taught our suicide prevention training, and the very next day, he took his own life. 90% of suicide attempts involving a gun are fatal. My way of continuing my service is to help protect my community by being a responsible gun owner and by storing firearms safely. Store all your guns securely. Help stop suicide.
Brought to you by End Family Fire and the Ad Council.
Time out!
Right. Remember, we're a team that plays together. Listen, the winning will take care of itself. We just have to get everyone involved.
In interscholastic sports, we celebrate what makes every one of us unique. And in the pursuit of a common goal, everyone in the huddle, in the bleachers, and in the community comes together. This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
93.5, The Tap.
Why are interscholastic sports called the last classroom of the day? Because they teach students important life lessons.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, chance of rain, partly sunny, highs near 56. Tonight, some fog possible, otherwise mostly cloudy, and lows in the mid-30s. For Sunday, mostly sunny, mid-50s. Sunday night, mostly cloudy with a low around 43. Monday, around 57 with a chance of rain.
Right now, it's 49.
Back here on Morning Cannolis, playing this hour, previous hour, Rolling Stones all morning, along here with my terrific executive producer, Luke Mathers, coming to you from the studios of Civic Media in downtown Madison, right before the break, talking about these prosecutions against Donald Trump and others, these major events just on Thursday and Friday of this past week, of principles in the scheme, in the overall scheme to undermine our election, to interfere with the 2020 results. Ken Chesbrough and Sidney Powell now cooperating with the government, telling everyone, telling at least the prosecutors, state and probably federal as well, what they know about conversations with other defendants, including the former president. Also of significance, a footnote seemingly, but also important in understanding how these things work. And that is that, as we know in Michigan, the attorney general there, her name is Dana Nessel, has charged the fake electors with state offenses for engaging in the same kinds of conduct, trying to undermine the results of the Michigan election. Just this past week, among those people that she has charged there, a fellow named James Renner. He is a Michigan Republican. He was accused of participating in this fake electors scheme there, has had all criminal charges against him dropped. And the reason why that happened is because the attorney general there chose to do that. Why? Because once again, Mr. Renner, as a part of his agreement with the state, with the attorney general, is doing what? He is cooperating. He's going to tell information that he has to the state prosecutors about presumably other people charged in that case, presumably other contacts that he may have had, if any, with people in, oh, say, Georgia, in the federal government, among this large group of people identified for having been involved in the 2020 interference scheme. And this case against Renner is based upon an agreement between the parties. He is dismissed. No further criminal prosecution, but his agreement is he is now going to tell what he knows, much like Ken Chesbrough, much like Sidney Powell, much like the bail bondsman, also that third defendant in the Georgia case. All of that happening again in Michigan.
Well, Jim, that's kind of like the there's bigger fish to fry.
That's
analogy, right?
That is exactly it. And the fish happen to be human beings in this particular case,
yes.
Sentient beings who again, are plainly greeting all of this news about people one by one recognizing the exposure, Luke, that they have and saying, you know what, I need to talk to those prosecutors because I can limit my exposure. I can maybe stay out of prison, as Ken Chesbrough and Sidney Powell and the bail bondsman probably will, at least in the state side of things. And all I need to do is tell the truth. That's the agreement. I got to come forward and finally tell what happened and talk about those fish, those larger fish in the sea in which I swam. And that's exactly the analogy, appropriate analogy. That's why you're an executive producer here, Luke. You provide the appropriate understanding and appreciation for what's going on here in America.
Well, it's one of those oldest political science analogies in the book is the prisoner's dilemma, is how do you understand and cooperate when you don't know the other parties involved, what they're going to say.
Right.
And so it will be interesting to see what happens.
It will be very interesting. We'll monitor that. And you also want to be first in line line, or maybe close to first in line. If this continues over the period of the next several weeks, if 3 and 4 and 5 and 6 and 7, maybe 7 and 8 and 9 don't have as much to offer to the government. Right now, these people do. Not good news. Not good news for Donald Trump and his lawyers. Luke, appreciate that comment. We also appreciate Tom, who's calling in from West Dallas. And this, our moments here on Morning Cannolis. Tom, your comment or question about our subject matter this morning.
Thank you for taking my call. Once again, I am in awe of all your knowledge when you shifted gears to talk about the mail issues and how you knew things that quickly. I wish I had a mind like yours.
Tom, thank you for that. I assure you it's not that broad, but I appreciate the comment even so.
My question is, and I'm shifting gears as well, Republicans are dead set against giving some Republicans are dead set against money for Ukraine. But these same Republicans who are anti-Semitic, known to fraternize with Nazis, space lasers, and all that stuff, are all gung-ho now to give money to Israel, which, wow, they're Jewish, and you people keep talking about anti-Semitic stuff, and you hang out with anti-Semites, all that kind of stuff. What is the Republicans' game?
That is the question, right? It is more than just rhetorical, Tom. An excellent point about consistency, right? We should expect more in terms of our leadership, our appointed leadership, our elected leadership. You've identified one of the seeming profound incongruities in positions, right? This sense of great support for the Israeli nation, which is appropriate, their strongest ally on the face of the planet. And at the same time, as you said, affiliating, not exclusive, not completely, not the entire Republican Party. You hasten to add that, and I would say the same thing. It's not everybody, but the comments, the anti-Semitic comments, the other indications, the invocations of the Third Reich and Nazis and those kinds of things, seemingly wildly inconsistent. I would offer, in addition to your very good point here, that that's the kind of thing that all of us, as a part of the rule of law as we vote, should identify those inconsistencies and say, you know what, if that's the kind of way that your mind works, that you are that inconsistent, that incongruent when it comes to the administration of justice in America and the ways in which we even adopt policy, I'm not going to vote for you. That's the kind of thing that should, in fact, be on the focus of everybody out there. Those kinds of things, Tom, you're talking about right now. It is not just a rhetorical question. It is that, but it's so much more. Appreciate that comment, that question, that observation as well, profoundly. I promise that in our last minutes here on Morning Cannolis this Saturday, October 21st, we'd make a couple of footnote comments about something we're going to get back to next week, and that is the Supreme Court once again, already underway, having entertained 6 different oral arguments already. We've talked about some of those in previous broadcasts. They're back in business, oral arguments on October 30th. So next Saturday, we're going to talk more about what's coming up there. Just this past week, however, 2 important things about the legitimacy, the ethics situation involving the Supreme Court. Amy Coney Barrett, just this past week, spoke in favor of a U.S. Supreme Court ethics code.